and welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. And during the month of November, the USIP Global Campus is offering our online course on conflict analysis. And the main instructor for that course is Jeff Helsing. He's the Associate Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP. And he has also been my co-host for the podcast this month. So Jeff, as always, it's good to have you on the show.
Great. Thank you, Darren. It's great to be here, and I'm excited about our discussion and our guest.
As am I. Our guest for today's show is Lisa Schurk. She is the Director of Human Security at the Alliance for Peacebuilding, where she connects policymakers with global civil society networks. She facilitates civil-military dialogue and provides a conflict prevention and peacebuilding lens on current policy issues. Schurk is also a research professor at the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding at Eastern Mennonite University. She's currently working with a global network to write a curriculum on security sector and civil society engagement for human security. She is also currently working with the Swiss Federal Department of Foreign Affairs, Department of Human Security, as the lead researcher on civil-military guidance via the University of Notre Dame's Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. Now, I could go on with your roles, your accomplishments, your experiences, but I won't in the interest of time. So, Lisa, it's a real honor and a privilege to have you on the show. So thanks for joining us today in the studio.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and I look forward to the conversation.
And we're also joined today by many listeners from around the world, and we invite those of you who are tuning in online to connect with our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis. She will be moderating your questions and comments and instant messaging you during the broadcast. And we really look to listeners like you to help us guide this conversation and engage with our guest. So we invite you to notify Vanessa when you have a question or a comment by clicking that little raise hand button on your control panel. And Vanessa will get you queued up so we can unmute you and bring you into the show so you can share your question or your comment directly. If you do not have a microphone handy, you can also instant message your question to Vanessa and she can read it for you on your behalf on air. So with that, let's get started. I first want to let you know, Lisa, that your work and your scholarship has been referenced not only in this course on conflict analysis, but also in the course that we offered last month called Strategic Peacebuilding. And so I want to start by asking you, what is your definition of peacebuilding?
Okay. That's a great question because right now the field of peacebuilding is growing so rapidly and there's so many new people coming into it that people are defining it in really different ways. And often I find they don't understand the full history of this term and how it's developed. A lot of people point to it as a UN term, but actually civil society, NGOs, were doing peacebuilding and using this term decades ago, long before the UN. And actually this is a concept that has trickled up to the major institutions in the world. And so I define it in two ways. First of all, peacebuilding are specific efforts designed to address the root causes, the drivers of conflict, or the mitigators of conflict, the things that prevent conflict, in a way that aims to reduce violence. And that can be before violence happens, during it, or after it. The UN originally defined it as post-conflict peacebuilding, but most people in the field say now, actually, this is more of an umbrella term for all the different kinds of efforts aimed to prevent, reduce, mitigate, transform conflict. The other way the term peacebuilding is being used, though, is not so much the specific efforts, but more of this idea of coordinating many different approaches to responding to conflict. And so that approach is more about looking at how does the military support peace building, how do humanitarian organizations support peace building, how do government diplomats, development agencies, lots of different organizations do work which they do not refer to as peace building, but collectively they may have an impact that results in peace building if they are coordinated in a way where these efforts actually reinforce one another. Unfortunately, we don't often see that, so there's a lot of complexity and chaos often in conflict-affected regions where there's a lot of different actors doing different things with different goals, and it doesn't always add up to peace building. So peace building is trying to say these things should be coordinated better.
Okay, and take us back a little bit. Of this definition that you just provided us, mm-hmm. How did you find yourself getting involved in this work? Why did you decide to enter into this field of peace building as you define it?
Well, in the 1980s, when I was just coming out of college, the very first master's and PhD program at George Mason University had begun, and that was a master's and PhD in conflict analysis and resolution, which I went into. And that program was really one of the first university programs to really look at what we now call peace building, sort of what are the root causes of conflict, and then what are all the different kinds of efforts, conflict resolution mechanisms, we called them back then, that are available to respond and to mitigate and transform conflict. So I came at it, first of all, from an academic approach, but then when I started teaching at Eastern Mennonite University, most of our students were from Somalia, Kenya, Afghanistan, Iraq. This was back in the 1990s. And I quickly got a sense that actually, in many parts of the world, almost every country of the world, we've had people from hundreds of different countries at our Summer Peacebuilding Institute at Eastern Mennonite University. They were coming to us telling us the kinds of peacebuilding activities they were already doing in the 70s and 80s. And so I had the sense, okay, this has actually been around for a long time. There's been local innovations, local people responding to their own conflicts. So my orientation to peacebuilding for the last 20 years has been working primarily with those local organizations. This can be the Nairobi Peace Initiative based in Kenya, Accord in South Africa, the West African Network for Peacebuilding, the Mindanao Peacebuilding Institute in the Philippines, all over Latin America. There's all types of local initiatives, and so my orientation is coming from working with them on the ground as they respond to conflict and violence within their own context.
Okay. Jeff, do you think, going back to Lisa's definition of peacebuilding, or the kind of two definition of peacebuilding that she offered, do you think that there are other competing definitions of peacebuilding, and do you think it's important to have a shared definition of the peacebuilding field when conducting conflict analysis? In other words, is a shared definition a prerequisite to conducting a conflict analysis?
I don't think so. And the reason I say that is because of one of the things that Lisa said, is that for a lot of people or a lot of organizations, they don't consider what they're doing peace building. And I think if you start trying to get them under that umbrella, I think peace building becomes in some way something that people step away from. And I think what we have to do in the peace building field is actually to expand the understanding of how others contribute to building peace without necessarily kind of giving definitions and labels. Because a lot of the work we do, and we had this discussion a couple of weeks ago, was that in a lot of places, peace itself can be a very loaded term. And so because of that, I think we need to get people to understand, if they're working in healthcare or they're working in development or they're working on rule of law, that they actually have ways they can contribute to the building of peace without trying to get everybody under the same umbrella.
Mm. Do you then think that's one of the values of the curve of conflict framework that we talked about this week, in that it introduces all these various terms or professions or types of intervention along the trajectory of a conflict. Because Lisa, as you said, peacebuilding has become an umbrella term that represents not just the post-conflict work, but everything along the whole trajectory from prevention to mitigation. Do you think that's one reason why that curve of conflict is a useful framework? Because a lot of folks, depending on whether they're doing military intervention or humanitarian assistance, that they can find themselves along that curve? Is that one of the values of it?
I think it can be both finding themselves along the curve, but then in another way, because we've talked a lot about conflict analysis frameworks, that there are ways in which they can use good analytical tools to help them understand the context in which they work and the dynamics of understanding conflict better. So I think all of those tools can be useful if it helps them understand the nature of conflict, not just a particular conflict, but the nature of conflict, but also the context in which they're working.
What are your thoughts on the curve of conflict? This was brought up not only in the conflict analysis course this month, but in the strategic peacebuilding course. Mm-hmm. It was referenced and people grappled with it as well. And there's an interesting discussion online about its value in understanding conflict. Do you have an opinion on its effectiveness or value?
I think it has a place. I mean, there are times when you're really just trying to prevent things, and there's times when you're really trying to respond. But there's a lot of similarity between conflict prevention, conflict management, conflict transformation, post-conflict work. A lot of the principles are the same. And so I think when I'm teaching, I put more emphasis on sort of the critical thinking skills of trying to figure out how do you design programs that sort of find the more common ground between those approaches, because there'll be people working in all kinds of rarely do conflicts go up and then they mm-hmm. go down, like the conflict curve. They usually go up and down and up and down. And so I rarely draw the curve. If I do, I'm saying you're going to use a variety of different skills, in the 20-year span of conflict in Liberia or in Afghanistan. There are some principles regardless. For me, I think the importance of designing programs is more on those principles of relationships, and negotiation, problem solving, collaboration, participation, empowerment. Those commonalities of designing programs, I think, are consistent in each of those stages.
I've heard you use an analogy of a group of blind men who are touching an elephant, and then they share with each other what they think it is that's in front of them. And so how do you, maybe you could explain this analogy to our listeners and how this analogy is related to some of the issues around conflict mm-hmm. assessment and the various conflict assessment frameworks right. that different organizations and institutions are currently using.
Yeah. Excellent question. So that was really the question that motivated this book that I just wrote on conflict assessment and peacebuilding planning, because over the last 20 years I started realizing that the different government agencies and UN programs that I was working with were analyzing conflict in a really different way than the local civil society NGOs that I was working with. So when I was living and working in Kenya, for example, Kenyan civil society groups were really upset that the donors had such a different understanding of what was driving electoral violence than Kenyan NGOs did. And so, you know, donors were setting the request for proposals, and they were often vastly, you know, off track according to from a civil society perspective. A lot of the big donor agencies were sending out teams of 4 to 5 people to do conflict assessment for a week or two. So they'd go off to Iraq and do a 2-week conflict assessment. You know, they'd interview a few chosen civil society members, lots of government people, and they'd come back and they'd write their report. And then that conflict assessment report would be used to decide what the next request for proposal for work in peacebuilding in Iraq should be. And, you know, there was just this increasing gap I saw in analysis. So even though they were using the same tools often, the same conflict analysis frameworks, They were putting different data, different assumptions, different information and experience into those conflict assessment frameworks, and they were coming up with really different kinds of programs. And for the groups that I worked with on the ground, there was just tremendous frustration that the donors didn't spend longer on conflict assessment and didn't do more thorough research with a greater set of diverse people on the ground, because they felt like if you don't get the conflict assessment piece right, everything that flows afterwards is then also wrong. And so if you don't have unity of understanding, you cannot have unity of effort or unity of purpose, which is a military way of saying you can't coordinate people who are working on really basic different assumptions about what is causing conflict. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Is that because, in your experience, most outside agency, whether the UN or an international NGO, is that because they come to a country with every intention of doing good assessment, but with an already predetermined sort of either strategy or a set of programs already? So by definition, they're going to use whatever feedback they get to fit into what they already want to do. And is that what the local partners were saying? It's a fundamental first step that sounds like the problem.
Part of it is that, yes, organizations tend to see problems that they themselves can fix. And so if you're a big international NGO and you have a lot of gender empowerment training in your background, you're going to see a gender empowerment problem. If you do dialogue or people-to-people reconciliation programs, you're going to see that as the solution. So people tend to see the problems that they can fix. Here's an example. So several years ago, I was with a week-long simulation that the Marines were running on conflict prevention in the Horn of Africa, looking at piracy. And we did a conflict assessment as an entire group. And we looked at many of the factors. But really, at the end of the day, the military point of view was we have to figure out how to identify potential pirates before they become pirates and cut them off there. So it was more a matter of a targeting question, because that's what they do. That's most of their training, is about targeting and identification of an enemy. From USAID's perspective, it was a lot about, okay, we see a livelihood problem. These are young entrepreneurial men who become pirates. Actually, they're the most entrepreneurial in their society. We need to be rewarding them by giving them other options and doing livelihood creation programs, which is what USAID does well, livelihood creation. The NGOs who were at this simulation really saw this more as a governance problem. So it's their view of what was the root causes of piracy in the Horn of Africa had much more to do with tribal disputes, governance issues, you know, not only the lack of jobs, but the lack of schools, the lack of all kinds of opportunities for people. So they looked at it much more as a bigger development question. And so here, even though we were all together in the simulation and had the same information and case study in front of us, we interpreted that data according to our own assumptions, ideas, and our own approach to dealing with conflict. There was no way there was going to be unity of effort at the end of that simulation. And sort of really what it was is an exercise in looking at how different organizations are. And even if we have the same conflict assessment framework, it doesn't necessarily mitigate the conflicts that we have in our basic understanding of the way the world works or our basic theories of change.
So does that mean that from that experience and other experiences that you've had, is there a way to create a conflict assessment framework that can overcome that challenge? Or does that make the case for you really need, in this case, three separate conflict analysis frameworks that can help, you know, each particular approach be as relevant to the local needs as possible? And if so, then where do you get the collaboration, if that's even possible at the end?
to answer your question, do we need a better conflict assessment framework? No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. The problem actually isn't with the frameworks. The problem is with the process. Mm-hmm. So can you do a conflict assessment by sending out a team of people for a couple weeks? And for me, the answer is absolutely not. You will not get quality data that you can program good peace-building programs out of that. So in my book, I argue what we need is to separate the people who are going to be doing peace-building interventions from the assessment process. We need conflict assessment teams that are ongoing, composed of diverse insiders as well as outsiders who come from different perspectives and are looking at the conflict in an ongoing sort of way. I argue UNDP or the World Bank are the best institutions to really coordinate this at the country level. Because right now, each donor country does their own conflict assessment, and even the countries often disagree with each other about what's driving conflict. So if you had a conflict assessment team made up of insiders or outsiders, they could then provide a more unbiased, you know, they have nothing to gain by saying we think people-to-people programs might be a good idea. You would separate out the organizational initiative and desire to program something that they can respond to find something that they can respond to. But so I did this actually in Fiji. I was part of a UNDP team that was facilitating a discussion with the Fijian military government and civil society about the conflict in Fiji and looking about what could be done. And there was just an interesting way that when you have a group of 25 sit down in a workshop and do a conflict assessment, you're not trying to come up with an agreed, these are the set of, root causes that everybody can agree on. You're mapping, people in this region see this conflict differently, and different peace-building responses will respond to different interests. And so you get a much richer sense of, if we do this, we actually could be creating second-order effects that we hadn't anticipated, which is part of the reason why conflict assessment is so important, because if you get that wrong, you cannot anticipate what the unintended impacts of your peace-building program might be. And unfortunately, all too often, people with great intent end up causing even more division and conflict. So, yeah.
I'd like to invite our listeners online to chime in with their questions, comments, stories, experiences. If they have any, you can instant message our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, if you want to be brought into the show. In the meantime, I would like to raise a tension that I have noticed just in the last couple of weeks. So one thing I noticed or heard and learned from your presentations, Jeff, from the course so far, is the value of having a simple an elegant conflict analysis, something that need not be super complicated or, and maybe I'm hearing this wrong, take an incredibly long period of time. But I'm hearing from you, Lisa, that as you just said, it's not really useful to just go in and do a quick conflict analysis. And Jeff, I'm not saying that you're saying quick is equal simple, but there's this tension of, it needs to be participatory. It needs to be inclusive of the various actors, insiders, outsiders who are party to the conflict. And then finding a way to ask the right questions and get one perspective and see how it connects with another perspective and, you know, gathering information. Sounds complicated to me. And it sounds like it takes a long time if it's to be done right. So is there a middle ground here? Is that something that we're looking for? But how do we deal with the tension between a conflict analysis process that is simple and elegant with one that is participatory and inclusive and deals with all the complexities that are part of a conflict? I throw that out to both of you.
I think those are two separate questions, actually, because I think a simple framework is better, which is why that's what I tried to do in the book, is say a lot of these other diagrams have elaborate triangles and squares and circles, and I can't even understand them with a PhD in conflict analysis looking at it. So for me, it was scaring a lot of people off as I was trying to teach these other conflict assessment frameworks. This isn't that complicated. It's really about who is involved, why are they motivated, what are they doing, where is this happening, when are the triggers and opportunities. So the who, what, where, why, when is a simple framework. And there is a way of doing it quickly, too, I think, because you're absolutely right, which is the second part of your question, that you can never get a perfect conflict assessment. So any conflict assessment is better than no conflict assessment. So even if you're sitting in a room here at the State Department and saying, okay, what is causing the problem in Nigeria? It's better than if you don't have that conversation. But what I didn't see happening in the US government, but also in the Dutch government, in the UK, at DFID, nobody was asking, do we know what we don't know? So everybody's filling out these conflict assessment frameworks with a huge number of assumptions. Often there's nobody from Nigeria in the room, and there's nobody there to kind of challenge red team their point of view, to provide a bigger point of view. Let me just say, when I went to Afghanistan the first time, I thought I knew for sure as a conflict assessment expert, you know, I could quickly do something to understand what was driving the conflict in Afghanistan. I went 6 times, and every time I went, I was less and less confident of what I knew or what peace building programs I would design, because my map of what I didn't know or didn't understand in Afghanistan got more and more complex. And so this is what some people call analysis paralysis. You know, we don't want to get so dragged down. And some of us have the fear that if you start analysis, you're never going to finish it. So I think we have to solve that problem by being humble and approaching any peacebuilding design in a learning mode. So if you have humility and you're going to learn, monitor and evaluate your program as you go, you're recognizing, I don't know what I don't know, and I have to keep asking questions and keep looking about whether I'm really understanding the conflict. So conflict assessment is continuous, even though you start doing peacebuilding interventions to try to alter what you think are the drivers. It's an ongoing process. It's never perfect, but good enough is better than not at all, I think.
I couldn't have said it better than Lisa did. I'll just add two things. The first is that I think a lot of the conflict analysis frameworks that she's referring to that donor governments and agencies were doing, have done, took the focus and they kept thinking that we can, in effect, understand some other place by just creating something at this end. And what we need to do is provide. See, a framework was intended to provide a kind of set of priorities and an agenda and a roadmap for outsiders to know what to do when they got in country. And I think the idea that you put all the onus on what you develop from the outsider in had the relationship backwards. And so not enough was really being paid attention to the need to develop really good feedback mechanisms within the country itself. So much more, I would say, resource and time needs to be developed to what's done in country. Now, that presupposes that you have to make a sustained investment in the process in that country. And that requires a significant effort and time and research and the development of a local capacity for research and frameworks and modes of analyses within country. And that's where I think we've got the resource sort of mismatched in doing really good assessment. And as Lisa pointed out, I think the other thing that's a sort of a static, sort of overly complicated framework does is that it doesn't reflect two things. One is the fluid aspect of a situation, because how do you account for, well, this is what we're seeing today, but how do we account for changes, the differences in drivers as new things emerge? And secondly, I also found, and I know Lisa's done work in this area, a lot of frameworks were developed absent a theory of change. Mm-hmm. There really wasn't anything behind it, and it was all data driven. And I think that's one of the aspects that, mm-hmm. that needs to be incorporated, particularly if you're going to talk about organizational bias. Well, bias based on what theory of change?
Yes.
And I think that is often misunderstood or just ignored.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to The Peace Frequency. It's a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and today on the show, we are joined by our guest, Lisa Schurk, and she is the Director for Human Security at the Alliance for Peacebuilding. And she's also the author of several books that delve into the issue of conflict analysis and conflict assessment. And we're also joined by my co-host, Jeff Helsing, who is the main instructor in the online course that we were offering this month on conflict analysis. So we've been talking about a lot here, and looks like we actually have a question or a comment from one of our listeners. So I hand it over to you, Vanessa.
Yep. Lisa, there's a little bit of pushback on one of the comments that you made about the UNDP and World Bank being suitable conflict assessors. Diana wrote in, what is her rationale for suggesting the World Bank as an appropriate institution? I find that the World Bank often takes on areas that are outside of their scope and expertise. The institution is not diverse with about 90% economists.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. My first choice really is UNDP. What I'm looking for is an institution that is in almost every country of the world and can play a facilitating role. So I'm not looking for World Bank experts to come in and analyze the conflict. What needs to happen is you need an organization, an international organization that has the credibility to be able to invite the military and the government, as well as religious leaders, business leaders, academic, civil society, NGOs. You need somebody with the convening power. So at UNDP, the resident coordinator in many countries has that convening power and the existing relationships already. So it provides a platform for a facilitated conflict assessment. So that's different than the World Bank doing a conflict assessment, which I agree would not be a good idea alone. Because really what you need is a facilitator who can help people talk who are very different and see their own conflict in different ways. And again, you're not trying to reach a consensus. What you really want to do in a conflict assessment is map the different ways that people see their conflict.
So we've talked a bit about, just in the first half of the show, answering the what question, kind of what is conflict analysis, what kind of information are we trying to get from going through these types of processes, and also what are some of the challenges that have emerged in doing a conflict analysis well. I'd like to jump to some of the how. I think those are some of the really difficult questions. And I'm fresh back from a trip in Berlin. I was working with an organization over there that does peacebuilding work around the world, and they're interested in having their work be more participatory, both at the macro level in terms of how the operations, the missions, or the policies, how they're being implemented, but then also at the micro level, I think, in how people train to prepare people for these types of missions. So you have written about the Busan principles for effective development assistance, which I think connects to a lot of these concerns and interest in making peacebuilding work more participatory and more inclusive. So could you explain to us and our listeners, what are those principles and how do you see them as being relevant to the larger peacebuilding field, but also how we do conflict assessment?
Okay. So I would say this book that I wrote on conflict assessment is really about local ownership, because no development or peacebuilding works without local ownership, local leadership, local people being involved in every aspect, not just as participants in an interview from USAID that sends their team out, but you have to have local people involved. Now, it can't just be any local people either. I mean, I think what's happened now with the concept of local ownership is you get a couple of token people, and often they're not the best people, and you have a corrupt local leader, and then there you go. That's pronounced local ownership. But really, in any context, there are competing local forces. And so a local assessment process would need to be facilitated as well, because they will be competing local voices trying to make sure that their voice is heard. And that's why you need a big international organization actually to help moderate that and make sure that local people are heard and that diverse local people are heard. But that at the end of the day, the picture that is painted in a conflict assessment represents those local approaches, and that local people then are also the ones designing what kinds of programs would best address the problems that we have mapped ourselves. Does that answer the question?
It does. It does. I'll dive a little deeper. This is to both of you. How do you do that? So we might look back and say, oh, the engagement of local counterparts in this mission or in the conflict assessment process, we look back on it and we say, okay, that wasn't really someone who's representative of that community, or that individual is quite problematic because of corruption or what have you. I assume that oftentimes that's not necessarily known at the time. We look back and we say, okay, that was problematic. So how do you find the right individuals, the right institutions, the right groups to be involved in that type of process? And actually, Jeff, I'm thinking about a story that you shared in one of your training videos this week in the course, the Mozambique example, and how there were competing approaches to disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration.
Yes.
And maybe you could recap that story for us, because I think it's relevant and connected to what Lisa was talking about in terms of whose voices are informing the analysis that then generates the program or the project or the mission.
Yeah.
Well, and that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, in that one's particular either organizational or bias or expertise sort of frames the problem that you're trying to address. So the Mozambique example I used was the disarmament, demobilization and reintegration of combatants in Mozambique, in which the and this was actually UNDP, that they created a program that was based on reintegration, in which these ex-combatants were provided with tools to build their own shelter and housing, which from their standpoint was to help give them the skills they would need once they were back in their communities. But it had the opposite effect of what the security interest needed, because then you had these ex-combatants who felt they were being treated without respect, who began to question the credibility of the UN itself. Mm-hmm. It's not what they expected. And what they were not prepared for was this sense that, oh, if I'm going to go back to my community, I have to build my own house. And they had no shelter. They were in miserable condition. I mean, it sort of compounded itself. And these are the kind of unintended consequences that one talked about. Part of the problem was the lack of communication between the UNDP and the peacekeeping forces that had very different agendas. And what I think this speaks to is actually the need for somebody, and I think this is an example of why the UN has more effectively used sort of a special representative who is the coordinator of a broader effort to be able to see the big picture and to understand, you know, these different perspectives and create priorities that will, if you will, address the different sort of approaches, programs that are being developed. The other thing I think that's also important to consider in thinking about how to prioritize is the issue of sort of how do you ensure that not just a diverse local voice is heard or voices are heard, how many are enough? Which are the right ones? And, you know, you mentioned the corrupt government official. Where does the government come in? I mean, to ignore the government seems, you know, to sort of weaken what you need to achieve. Obviously, you need to account for the potential for corruption, but what voice, what role
Does one give the government, particularly if the government and the structural impediments are really huge obstacles to building peace? And so there's a lot of really tough obstacles that become problematic. And I think that's one of the things I find most interesting about the assessment that you've developed, Lisa, is that you come at this from a peace building lens and I think try to account for some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Our producer, Vanessa, is telling us we have another question or comment from one of our listeners.
We do. Suzanne is going to join us on the line, and she has a question regarding the idea of tensions and conflict analysis. So, Suzanne, you're all set if you'd like to ask your question.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Great. So this has been a great discussion. Thank you. I love Lisa's idea of separating the people who do assessment from those who do intervention, because, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And on the other hand, in my experience in doing mediation and facilitation in the domestic context and multi-party stakeholder negotiations, I found that the assessment was actually the first stage in the intervention. Mm-hmm. You can't do an assessment without having some effect on the setting, on the people, on the relationships. You start to build relationships for one thing. You begin to earn the trust of the people that you might later, you know, be working with as a facilitator or mediator. And by your questions, you start prompting them to think about their conflict a little bit differently, perhaps. So I guess I'm trying to reconcile those two things. On the one hand, like I said, I love the idea of having an assessment unit that doesn't try to promote a particular type of intervention. On the other hand, if you're going to go into a conflict setting and do some sort of intervention, being involved in that assessment is a really important first step, I think. So any thoughts on that?
That's a great question. And you're absolutely right that any type of conflict assessment is also a peace-building intervention, because when you, like in Fiji, I was telling you about the military, the government, the business community, religious leaders, civil society, at this conference that I facilitated, all analyzing their conflict, as they were discussing what are the root causes, what needs what is driving conflict at this point, you know, it's they're learning from each other about their different points of view. And while they didn't agree at the end, one of the things that they all agreed on was the need for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Then, you know, what was interesting then is that, you know, if UNDP had come in themselves and designed a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it would have looked completely different. And having these diverse local stakeholders discuss the need for one, and then the group really discussed who would be the best stakeholder at the table here to move forward with this idea. You know, would it be UNDP? Do they want to hand it over to an international group? And they decided no. They didn't want the NGOs involved. They wanted the church, the religious organizations, actually, because both Hindu and Christian leaders, they felt, had the right kind of authority, the cultural position within Fijian society to run a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They also have the local houses of worship where it could be held, you know, sort of. So they were analyzing the best group to carry out one of the peace building interventions as well. And so, you know, there weren't that many religious leaders at that, but I thought this is actually what a good conflict assessment forum should do. It should begin to explore who is the right stakeholder to do different types of peace-building interventions. And I guess that's another point I wanted to actually emphasize, is that there's not one theory of change. There's not one driver or mitigator of conflict. In any context, there's multiple drivers, multiple mitigators, and there are multiple theories of change, because conflicts are systems and they're complex. And so there will be many different activities going on at the same time. And the more coordinated that can be, I think the better. The humanitarians will never want to be called peace building. That is totally fine. They need to be impartial, neutral, independent. But in providing humanitarian assistance to those suffering, it does have a stabilizing effect. It does need to be part of the conversation, the plan for how do we reel back from violence? And so somebody needs to be looking at that piece of how do all these things coordinate together.
It strikes me also that when you talk about your experience in Fiji or just doing the assessment, that that becomes in some ways what we teach in conflict resolution, a facilitated process. Mm-hmm. And I think this fits with the questioner as well, that your process of facilitation, the questions you ask, are also revealing about yourself and your orientation, and certainly are going to have an impact on those that you're trying to build trust with. And so it's not just, well, you go in and you just ask questions for the sake of asking questions, that you're just getting information and feedback and so on. You're presenting yourself. And again, that how you're perceived, I think will have an impact on the prospect for potential cooperation and really developing a really, really useful program. And I think Suzanne's point about that the assessment becomes the first step. Oftentimes, there's an assumption, I would assume, on the part of the locals that this person is here as, you know, to put together something, you know, broader. And one of the things that I think we do a disservice is we oftentimes assume that locals are so sort of like tabula rasa, you know, well, they're new and they're new to this, and therefore they don't bring any of their own perceptions. But, you know, in most conflict situations that we work in, very rarely have those that we encounter either not encountered outside parties or certainly have some perception, accurate or not, mm-hmm. about, you know, outsiders and the role mm-hmm. of outside parties.
We have another question from one of our listeners.
We have two questions in that kind of deal with particular conflict analysis issues. One comes from Mustafa, who is wondering, how do you handle a situation in which conflict assessment actually exacerbates an existing conflict by drawing in and creating more local engagement in a conflict? And then Rose posed our very first question about violence over natural resources, which occurs very frequently in pastoral communities in Kenya. How do you assess and analyze those types of situations, design appropriate programs for intervention in that situation?
Okay, let me take that first one first, because in many places in the world, it is dangerous to do a conflict assessment. To even say there's a conflict riles things up, and it's dangerous to begin poking around in the wounds of a society. And that's basically what conflict assessment is. It's poking around at the wounds and trying to figure out where's the source of this happening. You know, I would say in some places you can't do conflict assessment. Maybe you can do context, anthropological assessment. I mean, you might have to call it something completely different. Needs assessment, even. A lot of NGOs know that anything that they're doing, if it says conflict on it, they have to be very careful. But a needs assessment, you know, there's different ways of framing this. So I think that, Mustafa, you should think about what is a safe way in this context to look at research on public attitudes and perceptions. And it might be a survey of economic indicators. You might use a different door other than conflict to try to understand how local people are perceiving their problems, how they identify the issues that they're concerned about. And it even then it might still be too difficult in some places. So I'm thinking Syria right now. It's mm-hmm. very dangerous to be poking around in the wounds of any community there. The land resource question.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know Kenya because you've lived there, but I think if you think about resource conflicts in general, oftentimes one has to really try and understand the value of the resource, the use of the resource, who controls it,
Are there are patterns of cooperation? And sometimes conflict emerges when those patterns of cooperation are actually destabilized, where there may have been shared land resources. And I don't, as I said, I don't know Kenya, but if you look at Darfur and Sudan, one of the things that really escalated that conflict was a longstanding pattern of cooperation over between farmers and herders, in which a number of mitigating factors, one being the introduction of chemical fertilizers, the other being desertification, sort of changed those patterns of behavior. So what we may call kind of a resource conflict also is a conflict that has to be understood in terms of not only people's livelihoods, but their traditions and how they've lived their lives and how they've interrelated with each other. And then on top of that, you can sort of layer in identity issues that can be tribal or religious. And so the complexities of a conflict, when you start, you know, doing the analysis as I just did in 30 seconds, you know, shows you how you really have to dig into a lot of different factors that it's very hard to just say, okay, let's isolate resources and that's it.
So I want to build off some of the questions that we've had come in and some of the experiences that both of you have shared. And it reminds me of some stuff that you've written about in your book, Lisa, that you talked about there are several problems with potential problems with conflict assessment. And you've alluded to a couple of them already, two of which are organizational interests and underlying assumptions and pre-existing views. And you explain these as being obstacles to conducting a conflict analysis. So how does the peace-building field overcome those obstacles? I dare say those are there. Organizations have either their model, like you said earlier in the show, we do dialogue, or we do gender issues, or we do land and conflict. So I'm going to view this conflict through that lens. And actually, I see that as being the value that I bring to this conflict, is that I see it through that lens. So the question is it possible to get organizations, institutions, and governments to suspend and discard the ulterior motives, maybe is a stronger word, their ulterior motives or vested interests that get them engaged in the peace building or stabilization work in the first place? You know, as Suzanne said, assessment is part of the intervention. Mm-hmm. And so if there are ulterior motives or vested interests behind the motivation of that intervention, is it realistic to presume that those can be discarded or suspended?
Well, if we want to be successful and sustainable in our peace building, I think we have to all acknowledge that the current approach is really limited, and we're getting less effective programs because we're not doing better analysis. Let me give a very specific example. There's a new donor who has a very large women's empowerment in Afghanistan grant to a variety of contractors. And the stipulation of the grant is that the money go to women's empowerment, but it's supposed to go to women. Well, in Afghanistan, this is tricky because the obstacles to women's empowerment in Afghanistan are not necessarily that women lack skills. So a donor program that has stipulations, the theory of change is there's a problem with the women, that if we fix that problem, then women can be empowered. But that's not really what the problem is. If you did more analysis of the issue of women's empowerment in Afghanistan, you would realize there's a lot of men restricting women's roles. So you will never get at that driver of the problem by giving women more training. Actually, you're going to make a lot of women frustrated because they're going to have a lot more training and skills, and they're still not going to be able to break through the roof. So here is this huge multi-million dollar donor program that, they probably went out. Yes, the gender is a problem in Afghanistan, but they did so little research into the obstacles to women's empowerment that it's the whole conception of this program is off. And so they're not going to get the impact that I think they want. I learned this actually from Nepal, where World Vision and a bunch of organizations got together and they do their conflict assessments together. They had the same theory of change of women's empowerment in Nepal. They thought that if more women were in government, there would be better governance. So they went out and they got a huge grant. They trained a bunch of women, and those women did not get elected, and they could not break through the structures in place. And so they went back to their community of interest, all the NGOs and government people working together, and said, okay, what is the theory of change? Well, it's not a matter of women's skills.
Well, I think we have time for just one last question. So Jeff, if you don't mind, I'll throw my question in there for the final one here. And I think it actually runs to the spirit of not only what experience you're bringing to this show today, Lisa, but also I think the spirit of the conflict analysis course in general. And you have said something, Lisa, and I don't know if I'm quoting you directly here, but I've heard you say that, quote, every research process is an opportunity for peace building. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you could help us unpack that quote a little bit. What do you mean by that? And what are some examples of that, where research has really opened the door and exposed the opportunity for peace building?
There is a particular conflict assessment tool, lens that I use, exercise really, that I use. I've used it in Afghanistan and Kenya and Fiji and many different countries. And you get a diverse group of people together and you have them divide up according to whatever divisions exist within the context. In Afghanistan, they divided into four the major ethnic groups, and then they do a timeline of their history. And as Uzbeks, Tajiks, as each ethnic group in Afghanistan wrote their history, you write it on a large piece of paper, each important memory that you have of the past in shaping the conflict as it is now. As the Tajiks and Pashtuns, for example, laid down their history, and then you walk along it to sort of look at where are the differences and where is the similarity, where's the common ground and how people from different ethnic groups see their conflict and where are the differences. People were having conversations with each other that were new. So these were the class I was teaching was at Kabul University. They were all peacebuilding NGOs, Afghans working in peacebuilding NGOs, but they had never really understood before this conflict assessment exercise that their fundamental view of history and what were the points of glory and the points of trauma for each ethnic group were very different. And that they had a lot more work to do actually, even within peacebuilding NGOs and trying to understand how do we then go out and try to create peacebuilding, recognizing that our narrative, our understanding of history is so different. How do we plan a future?
Great. Thank you for that. You've been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. Our guest on today's show has been Lisa Schurk. She is the Director of Human Security at the Alliance for Peacebuilding and also a research professor at the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding at Eastern Mennonite University. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us on the show today.
Thank you. Great set of questions.
And my co-host for the show has been Jeff Helsing. He's Associate Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP and also the main instructor in the course that we're offering this month through the Global Campus on conflict analysis. So Jeff, as always, it's great to have you as a co-host on the show.
And thank you, Lisa, because I think you've given us a lot to really digest and move forward with as we go into the last week and a half of the course. So
thanks.
Thank you again.
Great to be here.
And thanks to all of our listeners who are tuning in from around the world. We value your deep listening, your questions, and your comments. I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Our executive producer is Peter Weinberger. Our on-air producer is Vanessa Francis. Our off-air producer is Leah Cullens. Our sound engineer is Emily Mella. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. And again, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to hearing you again next week.